Hello, and welcome to Learning for Life at Gustavus, the podcast about people teaching and learning at Gustavus Adolphus College, and the myriad ways that Gustavus liberal arts education provides a lasting foundation for lives of fulfillment and purpose. I'm your host, Greg Castor, faculty member in the Department of History. Writing about my colleague, Dr. Haley Russell of the Department of Health and Exercise Science at Gustavus, one student said, quote, she goes beyond the role of professor and serves as a role model for me and many other students. She sets the bar high for students and herself, all qualities that I greatly respect and admire. Faculty share that respect and admiration, knowing as we do that Professor Russell is not only deeply committed to the education of Gustavus students, but also extraordinarily good at it. The recipient of the college's Swenson Bunn Award for Teaching Excellence in 2019, she currently serves as our Faculty Associate for Teaching Excellence through the John S. Kendall Center for Engaged Learning on campus. She not only thinks a great deal about teaching, she also, as convener of the Teachers Talking Series at Gustavus, provides opportunities for colleagues to engage in cross-disciplinary conversation about that most important part of our work. Haley earned her PhD in kinesiology from the University of Minnesota and joined the Gustavus faculty in 2016. In addition to teaching courses in sports psychology, foundations of well-being, and power and privilege in sport, to name just some, she publishes and presents extensively in her field. Haley's work in kinesiology and sports psychology and her interest in the psychological response to sport injury are important and, to me, quite intriguing. I've been looking forward to talking with her about all of that and more on the podcast. So welcome, Haley. It's great to have you.
Thanks so much for having me, Greg.
Yeah, my pleasure. I know we know each other. Oh, I should maybe stipulate full disclosure. You're also married to J.J. Aiken of marketing, the co-producer of this podcast. Without him, there would be no podcast. So, but that's not why you're here. But yeah, and you know, we haven't really ever had a chance to sit down and talk as much as we're going to now. So I've really been looking forward to it. You're teaching January term, right?
Yes, I am.
And what are you teaching and how is that going? Is it in person, hybrid, all that stuff?
I am teaching exercise psychology for the first time, and I'm doing it hybrid. So we started meeting in person yesterday, and it's going really well. This is a class that we are sort of thinking about as being an integral part of the exercise physiology major. So this has been an opportunity to test it out and see how students like it and how I like it and how Stephanie and I see it fitting into the major.
Oh, and that's Stephanie Otto, your colleague. And yes. Yeah. Okay. So, what is exercise psychology about? What is the course about exactly?
So exercise psychology is the study of both how exercise influences psychology and how psychology influences exercise. Mm. So in the first week we covered, sort of from an ecological model perspective, all the different things that potentially influence whether or not we exercise. So things ranging from policy to culture, to individual differences and interpersonal relationships. This week, we're covering how exercise influences mental health, so anxiety and depression, health-related quality of life, and talking about exercise-related disorders. And then next week, we move into evidence-based interventions to increase exercise in inactive populations. So we're covering a variety of things, and it's been really fun so far.
Man, that sounds like a course I should be in, although then I probably would feel guilty because I'm avoiding exercise by taking a course in why I'm avoiding exercise. But seriously, it sounds fantastic. I sometimes think, first of all, exercise seems to be the key to so much, right? But it's also so hard for I include myself in this to do on a regular basis. If only I exercise even 1/10 as much as I, you know, imagine myself doing. But it sounds great, seriously. And what about, so are you actually doing physical activities as part of the course?
So we're not doing physical activity as part of the course, although there are a few things they've done. So they started the course by doing a walkability assessment of their communities. Oh, cool. So one thing I really emphasize in the class is that when we think about exercise, probably the ideal exercise for most people is to walk for 30 minutes a day.
Love that. And that's
wise. Yeah. And it's accessible. It doesn't seem completely overwhelming. For many people, can be a manageable amount of time. So But one of the major barriers to that is that many communities are not walkable. So students started by doing a walkability assessment of their home community or the community where they were over holiday break. And then throughout the course, we have some walking breaks. So the weather's been so amazing in Minnesota this January that students have been going out in partners to discuss discussion prompts and record some data about their walking. So their heart rate, their steps, their energy output, those sorts of things for short bouts of activity. And that's also worked well with COVID restrictions because then they can space out more than when we're in the classroom.
Right. No, it really is. Seriously, it sounds fantastic. And so you'd not taught this before, I think you said. And are you team teaching it with Stephanie Otto or?
No, I'm teaching it alone. So often sports psychology and exercise psychology are taught together. And I've taught sport and exercise psychology together many times. But I really advocated for this being a separate course because I think for one thing, students often get very caught up in the excitement of performance enhancement of sports psychology, and exercise psychology seems less exciting and important. And I also think it just warrants a lot of time and has some unique theoretical perspectives that we should be taking with it. But Stephanie and I are thinking about it as sort of complementary to what she teaches. So okay. I think our exercise physiology major is amazing in that it prepares students really well to have tangible skills to go out into various workplaces. But what I was sort of thinking was missing was this behavioral part. So you know exactly what to tell someone to do if they want to start exercising for the first time, or if they want to exercise after having an injury or having some sort of major health event. But how do you get them to sustain motivation and enjoy exercising, which we know is something that many people don't do regularly, and that it's really hard to incorporate into our regular lives.
Yeah, boy, I'm being honest here. I have to resist turning this podcast into kind of a therapy session for me. So I'm not going to go there. I need help, but I can hire you as a consultant later. So it sounds awesome. And I actually maybe come back to some of, like you just said, some theoretical perspectives. Maybe we can come back to those. I've just always had ever since I was an undergraduate, I've been interested in psychology. I think I maybe just took one course, and then I read, you know, like a lot of people my age then, at least reading some Freud and Jung and, Wilhelm Reich, I think as well. But I find this combination of yours quite interesting. Let's work our way to that, the kinesiology and psychology. So tell us first a little bit about where you grew up.
So I grew up in a small town on the northeastern coast of Nova Scotia called Pictou, and it's a town of about 3,000 people. Growing up, I played sports, which is sort of my entry point to being interested in kinesiology.
What sports?
Well, it's a very small town, so you sort of needed everyone to play everything if you were going to field teams. So my primary sport was soccer, but I also played basketball. I swam competitively and dipped my toe into some other activities, hockey, volleyball at different times.
So a bit of everything. Wow. And, you know, you sent me a photo, I think, of where you and just, you know, several weeks ago, you and JJ were quarantined. Is that at the family home? Because it was beautiful. I mean, I don't know if it was on a lake or it was absolutely gorgeous. Maybe JJ sent it to me, not you. But anyway, it just looks spectacular. I've never been there to Nova Scotia, but man, it looked gorgeous.
Yeah, JJ and I were in Nova Scotia for 5 weeks over holiday, and we had to, part of the COVID response process in Nova Scotia has been a mandatory quarantine for anyone that enters the province. And so we were quarantining on the Northumberland Strait, so it was right on the ocean. And that was not my, not a family property. That is my college roommate's family property, Nicole, and they were very generous to let us use their spot for our 2-week quarantine.
Wow. Yeah, that looked like, I mean, it's funny, you know, probably someone, it's just occurring to me, someone's going to do a collection at some point of photos of, you know, quarantine places. Cause I mean, some of them are not so nice and some of them are just spectacular. A friend's daughter, a friend who lives in our building here in Minneapolis, his granddaughter, sorry, was doing a hockey camp somewhere up in Canada, and where she was quarantined at first too, it was just absolutely gorgeous, beautiful. I think it was on the closer toward Vancouver, maybe, but really beautiful as well. So you went to St. Xavier. It is university. Is that a liberal arts college, or how would you describe it?
Yeah, so I went to St. Francis Xavier for my undergraduate degree, and
St. Francis Xavier is what I meant. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, so we don't actually have a lot of truly liberal arts institutions in Canada, but we have primarily undergraduate institutions. And so that's how I would describe St. of X, as we call it. And so it was almost all undergraduate degrees, and in some ways quite similar to Gustavus, really community focused.
That's what I wondered. Yeah.
Small student body population, small student to faculty ratio. So all that kind of good stuff that we have at Gustavus as well.
Yeah, I wondered about that. So the parallel. So you're a faculty. I don't like the term faculty brat, but your mom. I don't know about your dad, but your mom's a prof there, right? Still.
Yes, she still is. So my mom is a clinical psychology professor at St. of X, and I started as a professor there shortly before I started as a student. My dad is a commercial fisherman. So he fishes lobster, scallops, tuna, herring. So completely different.
Career. Yeah, you know, I do remember. Actually, now I remember you telling me that, and I got hungry. Or maybe it was you or JJ sending me an email about all the good fish you had. I told you bring back fish or something like that. I can't remember. Or he sends it to you anyway. I was envious. Oh God, it's just, oh man, sounds good to me. I never experienced fresh seafood in a grand way or on a grand scale until I went to Boston for graduate school, and then just fell in love with seafood. You know, growing up, it was Mrs. Blank's, I forget, Mrs. Smith's fish sticks or something, just got off on occasional, trout and fish from Lake Coho, salmon, Lake Michigan. But man, yeah, ocean seafood, I love. So that's neat. So were you, I'm tempted to say, okay, you majored in, did you major in psych at as an undergraduate, or was that your minor?
That was my minor. So I majored in kinesiology, and at St. of X, you had to apply to the kinesiology major out of high school. So I decided right away at 17 that that's what I wanted to do, which was really just about a love of playing sports.
Okay.
Then minor in kinesiology.
So a couple of questions. First, was the psych minor, was that just the influence of your mom, or what do you attribute that to?
Yeah, I think it might have been the influence of my mom a little bit, although at 17, you don't want to be anything like your parents.
Right.
But I think part of it was that, and part of it, I just found it really interesting. I went into my undergraduate degree thinking I was going to be a physical therapist or physiotherapist, as we say in Canada. I had torn my ACL in high school. That was sort of the end of my sports playing. I worked really closely with a physiotherapist named Philip Ruiz, who became a very good friend and ultimately hired me to work in his physical therapy clinic during all of my summers of college and much of grad school. And that's what I thought I wanted to do. So I went in with that intention and then took a little different path.
Yeah, but I mean, you have a real personal connection to some of the work you're doing around sport injuries. So off to the University of Minnesota, you went for a PhD in kinesiology. Why there? Why the U?
Yeah, so after my undergraduate degree, I went to Wilfrid Laurier, which is just outside Toronto, and worked with a professor there, Jill Tracy, who was amazing and is just one of my greatest mentors. And I really didn't think I was cut out for a PhD. I didn't think all of that imposter syndrome stuff. I didn't think I was smart enough. I didn't think I was good enough at research, all of those kind of things. And then in my second year of my master's, I got a Canadian government research grant that are pretty competitive. And it just boosted my confidence in this huge way. That sometimes only external validation can.
Right.
So after that, and having a really positive experience doing my master's, Jill and I sat down, and she was very set on, if you're going to do a PhD, you do a PhD in a good program that's a good fit. And it doesn't matter where it is, and that you need a supervisor that you can work well with. You need a program that you're excited about. And so I applied to two programs, the University of Minnesota and then Texas Tech in Lubbock, Texas.
Oh, I'm glad you came to the U. Sorry, Lubbock.
And those were both places I had never been before. So they flew me in for interviews. And the professor in Lubbock was wonderful. And he actually wrote for me for tenure last year. Oh, nice. He maintained a great professional relationship, but I could not imagine living in Texas.
Hello, especially Lubbock. I'm sorry. Lubbock,
no, it was rural. It was just a really huge culture shock from from being in Southern Ontario and before that in Nova Scotia. So I decided on the University of Minnesota. It was a great program. The advisor I worked with, Dr. Wiese Bjørnstad, is just a leading expert in psychology of injury, which is what I wanted to study. And I was excited about the curriculum. So I came to Minnesota for 36 hours during a snowstorm in February and somehow was still convinced that this was the right place.
Yeah, snow in the Twin Cities. The snowstorm in the Twin Cities beats Lubbock. Again, I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm laughing partly because my wife, Kate, when we were on the job market long ago, she interviewed with some people from Texas Tech at a history convention somewhere out east. But you know, she always jokes about one of the things they said. They said something about, you know, it being a dry town, at least then. And, you know, but there is alcohol, maybe, you know, the next town over or something like that. I mean, that was, you know, their recruiting effort.
Lubbock. That reminded me of my experience in going there. I was housed with a graduate student who was really nice. And I, because she was housing me, I decided I would bring her a gift. And it was during the 2010 Winter Olympics in Vancouver. And so I brought her this blanket that was official merchandise from the Winter Olympics in Vancouver, and she didn't even know there were Winter Olympics. Interesting.
That's great. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So what is, you know, I said, I want to ask you, what is kinesiology, but I'll preface it by saying, I said in a recent recording that I thought I had encountered the word in graduate school, but now I'm thinking about it after that. I'm not sure. I know for sure I encountered it when my wife, Kate, some years ago took up Pilates and then something called gyrotonics. She kind of does more gyrotonics now. That's the first time I heard about it. And then someone who lives in our condo building here in Minneapolis, I believe their son may have done a PhD in it as you did. But what is kinesiology?
So kinesiology is the study of human movement, is the definition of it. And it encompasses a whole bunch of subdisciplines. So sports psychology is one, motor learning, exercise physiology, biomechanics, sometimes sport management will fall under there. So it's the multidisciplinary study of human movement.
And was there anything like that at Gustavus before you came?
Yes. So Gustavus, one of the challenges with kinesiology is that no one's ever been that consistent on naming it. And that was a big takeaway for me from my PhD program was one of my professors there made a really strong argument for we should all be calling our programs kinesiology. And so at Gustavus, we call it exercise physiology, I would say, and we cover some of the subdisciplines, but since I came, I think we're starting to think about covering some other subdisciplines as well. But because our health and exercise science program is at Gustavus is three separate majors, it's hard to then cover a breadth of areas when we have to cover health education, athletic training, and exercise physiology.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. So what brought you to Gustavus? Was it just, I'm in Minnesota, I've heard of this place. How did you wind up coming to Gustavus and joining our faculty, which we're, of course, thrilled about?
So right after graduate school, I took the first tenure track job I was offered, which was in Pennsylvania. And it was during that sort of crazy time of graduate school when you're trying to finish your dissertation, you're also on the job market, you just are sort of working all the time. It's all very chaotic. And I was offered a job very quickly at a school in Pennsylvania. And so in 2014, I went there and realized almost immediately it was a bad fit. And so I decided that I was going to really actively job search, and I was either going back to Canada or coming back to Minnesota, because I deeply love Minnesota. I also deeply love Canada and would love to live in Nova Scotia again someday. But I loved Minnesota in graduate school, and a lot of my friends from graduate school stayed here. And so when the job at Gustavus came up, I was really excited to apply. And part of that was the small liberal arts environment. I was at a large public institution in Pennsylvania, and it just really didn't align closely with my values in education. And I really love teaching, and I want that to be the priority. And Gustavus allows me to do that.
Yeah, and come back to that, your love of teaching, commitment to it, and absolutely central to Gustavus. So, I mean, was it that a job opened at Gustavus in your area? Is that how it worked?
Yeah, a job opened. I was actively searching the Chronicle and higher ed. And when it came up, I was just very excited about the possibility of the position, which was teaching all different types of exercise science majors, and then also students across campus. So I really loved that idea of teaching students all different majors.
Yes. Had you been to Gustavus before or not?
I had been to Gustavus once. A friend in graduate school collected some data for her dissertation here and invited me to come help her. So my entire memory of coming to Gustavus was going into a classroom at Lund and collecting data from some youth sport athletes who were at a camp, and then going for a walk in the Arb. And that's basically all I know about Gustavus.
That's funny. The amazing Lund Center, which I don't know. How would you describe Lund Center? Athletic facility? My goodness. I mean, it has everything. It's pretty amazing. Yeah. Kate and I had not heard of Gustavus. She grew up in New York City. I grew up in the burbs of Chicago. But I sort of like you, I was on the job market, and I saw an ad, and I just reading that ad, I thought, I was at the convention, actually, big history convention in New York. I said, that's me. Oh my God, that's me. You know, that great feeling. Of course, God knows how many other people are saying the same thing. And then when I came out for the interview, I really loved the vibe. I wasn't crazy about the small town, I have to say, because I'm a big city guy, but I loved the vibe and the colleagues I met. And you know, it's kind of like, you know, what students say when they're touring campuses, right? Can you see yourself belonging there or fitting there, whatever words we want to use? And I felt that very strongly. And I remember calling Kate and telling her that, you know, right away. So the rest is all history. But I've been here. You've been here. This is your fourth year. I think this might be my 32nd year or something like that. But, you know, I did not attend a liberal arts college. My wife, Kate, did at Bard College in New York. But I wanted to teach at such a place. And I agree with you. I love the fact that, one, I don't have to specialize in my teaching. I can teach to my specialty, you know, graduate school specialty, but I don't have to just do that. And that I get to teach students from all kinds of disciplines and interact with faculty from all kinds of disciplines. And one of the things that impresses me about you is, you know, not just how good at teaching you are, excellent you are, but also how much you think about it, but also your, you know, you seem to have this ability to really connect across the disciplines. I wonder, both in the Teachers Talking series that you kind of convene, direct, but I think in other ways as well. Is that something you're consciously setting out to do?
I don't know if I'm consciously setting out to do it, but it's been feedback I've received my whole life that I really like people. I'm really social. I like all kinds of different people. Forming close relationships is incredibly important to me. And I think one of the things that was lacking from my first tenure job was that I had almost no social relationships. And when I came to Gustavus, I just like, I need to prioritize this. And it was really easy at Gustavus. I met wonderful people in my department. I tried to go to as many things as I could. And you mentioned teachers talking. When I first came to Gustavus, I went to every teachers talking, in part because it was such a great way to meet people. And also took part in all the new faculty orientation and really made it a priority that I wanted to be, I wanted to get to know people across campus. And that has made this place not really feel like work. It always feels like sort of a project we're all doing together. It's a fun community.
That's a great, you know, that's a fantastic way to put it, a project we're all doing together. I've never, that's exactly right. It's why, you know, God, I miss my office, but I also just miss this sort of, you know, I guess it's water cooler talk. There's not really a water cooler, but just that all those casual conversations, they can be fleeting and quick, but they're so important. I really, really miss that a lot. So I can't wait to be vaccinated and get back there. But I really like that, a project we're all doing together. It's true. That's exactly the feeling I had, by the way, when I came for my interview, because I was in the guest house. And while I was in the guest house, I think I was checking in maybe it was the end of my first interview day. The then associate dean, who became a colleague in the history department and dear friend, Tom Emmert, he was hosting a wine and cheese party for faculty, kind of celebrating the end of the semester and all their work for the, and I thought, God, this is great, you know, and I just was able to, you know, join in and felt right at home. It was clearly this, you know, connections across disciplines and friendships you could sense. So I really value that as well. So let's talk a little bit about teachers talking, because that's I think in some ways even distinctive part of Gustavus. Tell us a little bit about what that involves and your role in it.
Yeah, so I'm the Kendall Center Faculty Associate for Teaching Excellence. And that involves doing programming for faculty to improve teaching, to talk about teaching. And in non-COVID days, what Teachers Talking is it occurs over lunchtime, and members of the faculty or staff, campus community, will do a short presentation about some area of expertise or interest to them. And then it's held over lunch. We then have lots of informal discussion. And I think I, as a faculty member, certainly got so many great ideas from that format. Yes. And it was also just a fun way to learn from each other and connect with each other. So
yes.
Now I plan those. And this year they've had to be different because of COVID. So we're doing some online teachers talking, which have gone well. There's been some really interesting discussions. But I'm looking forward to when we can do it over lunch in person.
Yeah, I presented at a few years ago with colleagues a colleague in classics, Yuri Hong, and maybe one other person. Anyway, but yeah, it's amazing how much you can learn just hearing your colleagues talk for more than 3 minutes, you know, in passing. Again, I miss those conversations too, but they're a bit more ephemeral. So yeah, I think it's a neat program. I think it's also morale boosting, right? Because we're all sort of dealing with some of the same issues as teachers. So thank you for doing all that work. What else are you doing as the faculty associate? Are there other responsibilities or gigs that you have?
So probably the biggest focus this year, of course, has been online teaching. And so at the end of the spring semester last year, Brenda asked me, the provost, Brenda Kelly, asked me to do some summer programming about online teaching. And I'm certainly not a teaching expert. I'm just someone with an interest in teaching. So I spent a lot of time reading and researching and going to webinars, trying to learn about best practices in online teaching, and then did a multi-part summer workshop on online teaching that I think was really, it was certainly really fun for me, and also just really collaborative to get great ideas from other people across campus when we had to move to problem solve teaching in a way we'd never taught before.
Right.
And that was my favorite part of that work, was so many people were doing such interesting things. And I think these Kendall Center programs allow us to hear about that when we might not otherwise hear.
Yes, definitely. There was no such thing as a Kendall Center when Kate and I arrived. In fact, John Kendall, for whom it's named, was a beloved professor and I'm sure award-winning teacher in the psychology department at Gustavus. And he, in fact, was the president of Gustavus when Kate and I came. And I remember him interviewing me. And I was so impressed that the president of the college is interviewing me. Wow, this is amazing. But yeah, without the Kendall Center has done so much to bring us together around teaching and also research. And again, I just think it's so important for not only for intellectual vitality, but just kind of, you know, esprit de corps, right? I think is really part of it too. So I want to talk a little bit about your work and your teaching, because I do find it fascinating. I mean, I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit more about what, now that you've told us what kinesiology is. By the way, does study of kinesiology, does that require you, I would think, to take things like biology or anatomy? I mean, what do you have to do that?
Yeah. So in undergraduate, I took a really broad spectrum of courses in kinesiology, and we could choose in our degree to either do a bachelor's of arts or a bachelor's of science in kinesiology. And that just determined what your electives sort of were. So my electives were all English and sociology and psychology, whereas those who took a science focus would take biology, chemistry, and physics. Okay. But in our sort of core classes, we took anatomy and physiology, biomechanics, exercise physiology, as well as things like ethics in sport, sport psychology, sport sociology, child growth and development. So a real range of topics.
Yeah, I mean, that's amazing. It's quite interdisciplinary, really. Mm-hmm. So let's start with sports psychology. I'm not an athlete, as I said. I do watch some sports. You know, I love to walk. That's, I guess, right now probably my primary form of exercise, especially in a city. But what is sports psychology, and what do you do with it as a teacher and researcher?
So sports psychology is the study of psychology's impact on sport and sport's impact on psychology. So we study both things like, I think people often think about sports psychology as like mental skills training. So get high performing athletes to perform even better. How do you help people overcome performance anxiety or improve confidence? And that's part of it. And then also part of it is thinking about things like, how does playing sports influence self-perceptions in children? How does participating in sport increase or decrease the risk of eating disorders or depression? So there's a variety of topics that are studied that really have come to that focus of sport's influence on psychology and psychology's impact on sport.
That's so interesting and important. I mean, because sports are such an important part of our world, not just the, you know, not just the professional sports, but in so many ways. So, I have to admit, when I first thought about sport psychology, that's kind of what I thought. It was just a way to be do extreme sports or, you know, be even, I don't know, exercise harder, but it's much more complicated and I think interesting than that. And I'm especially intrigued by, your work on the psychology of, if I'm saying it correctly, the psychology of sport injury. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so this interest started in my undergraduate thesis. And so as I said earlier, at the time, I thought I wanted to be a physiotherapist, and I was working in a physiotherapy clinic in my summers and holidays. And I realized in doing that work that I was less interested in the rehabilitation part. So I was less interested in guiding people through their exercise or even problem solving what their injury was. But I was really interested in how do you get people to do the exercises? Because that was a constant theme in the clinic, is that we would prescribe, or the physical therapist would prescribe exercises that would treat, let's say, lower back pain. Yeah. And then people would come in and they either hadn't done the exercises or done the exercises sporadically. And I think we have this in our often biomedical model, this idea of just we should take a pill and something will be fixed, or we want the impacts of whatever treatment we're doing to be really quick. And that's not the case often with rehabilitation exercises or with exercise in general. So I was really interested in sort of that motivation and adherence part. And also really interested in how people responded to getting injured. And that had been my own personal experience, that tearing my ACL at 16 or 17, however old I was devastating at the time.
It must have been devastating.
Yeah. And as an adult, I have much more perspective and have much less athletic identity and better coping skills and all those sorts of things. But at 16, it's just like the worst thing that could happen in your, or certainly was in my sort of little world. And then as I started doing some research for an undergraduate thesis, I saw that was a really consistent theme in the literature, that because, as you said, sport is so important in our society, athletes often end up with this really strong athletic identity and unidimensional identity where they're an athlete above everything else and at the expense of everything else.
Yes.
And so when that identity as an athlete is threatened, they tend to have a really negative emotional response to becoming injured. And that often leads to really negative behavioral responses, like hiding the injury symptoms or continuing to play while injured. And this is all sort of wrapped up in our society's value of sport and our society's value of playing through pain and sacrificing for sport and being tough and being masculine. And there's just layers here. So I was really interested in all those things.
And yeah. Go ahead. Sorry. Go ahead.
No, that's okay. You go ahead.
Well, no, I just find it absolutely fascinating. I do. And I like that phrase, athletic identity, which I've not heard before. And it makes a lot of sense to me. And even I'm thinking of some people I know who aren't, they're not professional athletes. They're my age or older, but for whom, man, I don't know. It seems like it's all about exercise. To me, they seem like addicted to exercise. That is all they talk about, all they do. I mean, I'm exaggerating a bit, but I'm curious, you know, I was waiting for you to mention, if you were going to mention something about masculinity, which is another area that interests me a great deal, but I'm just curious, are there gender differences in how women and men respond to athletic injuries, or is it basically the same? Psychologically, I mean.
Yeah, I would say there's not enough research to draw really strong conclusions there. I think we have this overall idea in sport that is prevailing, that sort of women are weaker than men. And I'm not sure if that plays out when we look at evidence. But yeah, I think there's not a ton of gender differences there, although the social structure for men and women in sport is often quite different. And sport really has its roots in masculinity. And men often have even more athletic identity because there's this perception that they could go on and play professional at a higher rate than women. Women have some professional opportunities, but not nearly as many as men. So the narratives for men growing up in sport or boys growing up in sport are that you could be a professional athlete. You could make your life, make your career being a professional athlete. And that's less common for women. So there certainly are lots of differences in the social structure of sport for men and women. But I'm not sure the research plays out so strongly that there's difference in psychological responses. Men and women tend to both have a lot of negative responses to
Sure, because I can see, I mean, if a woman has that athletic identity, right, there's got to be similarities, no matter whether you're a man or a woman, if you're identifying yourself that way. The gosh, now I'm thinking, from this podcast, I have a growing list of people I want to team teach with. And now you're one of them, because I would love to team teach. Like, seriously, it would be fun. Or maybe you already do this, but a course on sort of gender and sports or masculinity. Well, I don't know, manhood, womanhood, and we'll figure it out. Sports would be fun. So you mentioned much earlier when we were talking about exercise psychology that there are some theoretical approaches. I wonder if you could just say a word for a layperson like me about what some of those theoretical approaches or insights are.
Yeah, so I think the really basic one, and I'll stick with my sort of area of expertise in psychology of injury, is the integrated model of response to athletic injury. So for one thing, we have a number of psychological factors that can predict injury. So stress being the big one. So when an athlete is at increased stress, they're at an increased risk of injury for a couple of different reasons. One could be that they have an increased level of distraction, so they're not ready for hits in things like hockey or football. Others could be the psychological and physical toll that stress plays, that people who are more tired are at a higher risk of getting injured, and that we don't necessarily move our bodies as naturally when we're holding a lot of muscle tension because of stress. And so that is sort of one of the predictive frameworks for thinking about the relationship between psychology and injury. And then in terms of response, it's really a cognitive behavioral model where when someone becomes injured, they bring with them into the injury lots of previous demographic characteristics. So they bring in things like their athletic identity, but also things like social support and socioeconomic status and race and access to healthcare and all kinds of different things. And so the injury and their own personal characteristics will then predict how they think about the injury. So do they appraise the injury as being the worst thing that's ever happened? Do they have a narrative where they were going to be a professional athlete? That's the only option for them. Or do they see it as a manageable challenge that they can overcome? That then influences how they feel about the injury and ultimately how they behave. So do they engage in adaptive coping? Do they seek social support? Or do they engage in negative behaviors like avoiding rehabilitation or being socially isolated, going into some negative coping behaviors, drug and alcohol use? And then the relationships between the thoughts, feelings, and behavior interact to determine the rehabilitation outcomes. And that's sort of the framework from which we think about the psychological response to injury.
Man, I just honestly, I'm sitting here smiling because I just find it so interesting. So yeah, it's in a way, it's obvious that, sure, it's not just a physical thing, right? The injury, there's a whole thinking about it and feeling about it, but it's never really occurred to me until speaking with you now, just how deep and profound that is. I mean, all the implications, right? Not just like, well, you know, you pulled a muscle or you did this. And so, you know, just as you said, take this pill or, you know, do some exercises and it's all better. There's a whole cognitive and psychological component to all of it. I mean, how the person processes the injury. It's absolutely fascinating. So you must deal with, I assume you deal with students at Gustavus who suffer athletic injuries or not? Is that something you engage in? I mean, counseling them or helping them?
No, I don't really engage in sort of the practice much. I've done a little bit of sports psychology practice, not at Gustavus, so at okay. with some runners primarily in Minneapolis, but that's not so much the focus of my work. But something I've been doing lately, which has been really fun, is that Lucy Holmgreen in Psychological Science and I, so she's a clinical psychologist, both sort of co-oversaw a presidential scholarship grant, so for student-directed research, and worked with a student who graduated last year named Maggie Leiniger. And we were starting to think about interventions for athlete mental health generally from a coaching perspective.
Okay.
So we started thinking about, and we presented this for the MIAC, which is the Minnesota Intercollegiate Athletic Association, and would ultimately like to do some more work in this area. But I think there's this overall idea, and certainly this played out as being supported by research in the 80s and maybe even the 90s, that athletes were more mentally healthy, so to speak, than the general population. And more recent research has found that that's really not the case in the college athlete population. So college athletes have very similar mental health status, so similar rates of anxiety and depression as the general student body. So I think the changing context of sport has led to meaning that sport has become incredibly important. It involves a large time commitment. It is associated with a lot of pressure. May right. not allow for the protective or potential protective benefits of the physical activity component. So that's something, and I've done a little bit of work with the athletics department broadly in programming for student athletes. So some mental skills training workshops with lots of athletes. And we did a reading group last J term on sport confidence. So I've done a little bit with athletics at Gustavus.
Mm-hmm. That's cool. That's all. Athletics, as you're saying, it's so important, not just in the society, but especially at the college, the university and college level. It's amazing to me, I guess no longer surprising, but amazing to me how many students come to Gustavus specifically for, or primarily for, it seems, the chance to play in a particular sport, right? Because we're Division III school, and they have more of an opportunity, it seems, to play. And then conversely, how some students leave when they realize, oh, I'm not going to get to play as much as I thought. But I mean, it's so important. And I do, I mean, you must. I mean, I encounter students sometimes who are trying to do just too much. I mean, they're maybe in, you know, multiple sports and trying to, you know, get straight A's or whatever they want. It's not always doable, and just creates so much anxiety and stress. It's hard to watch sometimes as a professor, as a teacher. That all, honestly, I could do a whole podcast just on all of that, which sounds so amazing to me. Let's talk a little bit in the time remaining about a couple of other things. One is the exciting new master's program. Is it an athletic training that's being developed? And say what you can about that.
Yeah. So the Athletic Trainers Association decided a few years ago that they were no longer going to accept undergraduate degrees as being the terminal degree to be able to practice in athletic training. So schools had to either choose to transition to a master's program or sunset their undergraduate program. And so Gustavus is in the process, after getting support from the faculty, to launch the first master's program at Gustavus. And so I've sort of, which is in a master's in athletic training, and I've been at the periphery of this. This has been spearheaded by Mary Westby in the HES department. But it's a really, I think, exciting opportunity for Gustavus. And I'm really excited that I will get to teach some sports psychology and some psychology of injury in that program. So it's sort of still in a process place now, but it's been something that's been years in the making. And when I was thinking about what type of school I'd like to work at, the idea of working with athletic trainers is just so exciting, because Mary and I have been able to collaborate on some research. And I just think there's so much overlap and necessity for multidisciplinarity in the work I do. So it's been nice to be able to be in a department with athletic trainers. And I'm excited about the prospect providing master's level research in athletic training.
Yeah, no kidding. That's exciting. And then will it be, so let's imagine I'm a student at Gustavus, I'm pursuing my BA, and then would I be able to then just sort of apply to that program? And would it be a 1 year program or 2 years?
It's a 2 year program. And I think there's going to be a couple of different options. And this is all sort of tentative, but the plan would be to do a 3-2 program, where students could do 3 years at Gustavus and then transition into, or as an undergraduate Gustavus and then transition into the athletic training master's. And students from outside Gustavus could complete their bachelor's degree and then come into the master's program as well. So a different group of candidates, hopefully.
Yeah, no, it's exciting, and good luck with all that. Look, actually, all of us, I think, on the faculty look forward to seeing that develop, and it's kind of, as you said, it's a first, right, for us. Mm-hmm. So it'll be interesting to see. The other thing I wanted to ask you about, as I said, there were a couple of things, is, you know, you are an excellent teacher, and I say that not just because, you know, you won the Sven Bunsen Award in Teaching Excellence. I mean, that just is a validation of what anyone who knew about your teaching already understood. But what is it, I mean, if you were advising, let's say you're mentoring new faculty at Gustavus or a place like Gustavus, what kind of advice would you give them regarding teaching? You know, in terms, I know there's no one formula, right? But I'm just curious about that because you think so much about teaching, and you know you are a mentor to so many, both formally or kind of officially and unofficially. What are your thoughts about what it takes to be an excellent teacher?
I think my answer to that has sort of changed over time. The first time I taught was in my PhD program, my first semester. They gave me a textbook and 35 students and said, teach this. And I spent like 40 hours a week preparing for teaching every week. And I found it stressful and overwhelming and also incredibly rewarding. And I think I'm lucky that I have found teaching fun since I started. And I think that's how I think about going into the classroom, is that if I'm not having fun, they're definitely not having fun. Yes. And for me to be able to have fun, I have to be really well prepared. I have to have really thought about what I'm going to talk about. I have to be constantly trying to improve it. And then no one wants to listen to me go on for 50 minutes. So I try to incorporate lots of different opportunities for them to do activities. So it's nothing all that groundbreaking, I don't think. But I think we have to enjoy what we're doing. And it's painfully obvious to students if we don't. So, and I think COVID has made me really prioritize less is more. So yes. I have to cover every possible thing.
Right.
Cover the things that I think are going to be most interesting, more important, and cover those well.
Yeah, music to my ears. I mean, maybe in your discipline, certainly in the history discipline, my discipline. You know, this tension between coverage and what some of us would rather focus on historical thinking skills. To use that overword, to use that overused word. But what you just said about, I'm kind of jumping out of my seat here with a big fat grin on my face, because what you just said about enjoyment, having fun, is absolutely true. I have learned that kind of like you, the hard way. I used to think, oh my God, I have to teach everything in this textbook. I have to have every lecture typed out. I have to have everything, you know, super tightly scripted. And I was lucky. I mean, I had good informal mentors at Gustavus. There was no formal mentoring in my early years and Kate's early years. But I'll never forget a professor, now retired, saying, Byron Nordstrom, you know, basically just, you know, jot some things down, you know, and he showed me how he had done that. I went in with type pages of type notes and, you know, and man, was that liberating. I also read a book about that around the same time. And it's just, you know, to be able to be spontaneous, just to have fun, right? And to also recognize that fun and hard work and learning are not all mutually exclusive. They all go together. So yeah, I think that point you just made is really important. And of course, you're absolutely right. Students know. We were students. We knew, right? You can tell. It's easy to tell who's enjoying and who isn't. So good, very good advice. Finally, earlier you also referenced, I don't know if you used the word awesome. Awesome, you may have, but awesome. I'll put that in your mouth if you don't mind. Exercise physiology major. What's your pitch for that at Gustavus?
Oh, what is my pitch for exercise physiology? I think any of our health and exercise science majors are great. But my pitch for exercise physiology, which is the most similar thing to what I did as an undergrad, is that it provides a lot of different opportunities to think about the human body, to think about health, to think about sport, and provides lots of opportunities to think critically about sport. And physical activity, I think, are something we think we know everything about. So if you play sport, you think, I know what's important in sport. I know all these different things about sport. And there's a whole body of literature that tells you you probably don't know as much as you think. And I think it's such a wonderful opportunity. And that's my favorite part of doing first-term seminar teaching, is introducing students to these ideas of critical thinking about something we've taken for granted, sport and physical activity. And that's only enhanced in the exercise physiology major. And I also think there's just great people in the exercise physiology major, as there are so many majors on campus. But it's a great avenue into either going right into the professional field as a personal trainer or working in rehabilitation settings, or going on to graduate school in physical therapy, physician assistant, lots of different things. So I just think lots of opportunities, and it's a fun major, and you get to take really interesting things like Stephanie Otto, I think, is the best group exercise teacher in the world. And she teaches a class on group exercise. And yes, that's, I think, just something really unique at Gustavus, and also such a great skill for students to come out with, that you can always find group exercise classes to teach. So some of my students who have graduated in that major will teach aerobics or teach yoga while they are in graduate school or while they're working other jobs. And I think there's just so many tangible skills as well as critical thinking skills that come out of this major.
Right. I mean, I would think, yeah, exactly. It's not that everyone who majors in that becomes an athletic trainer necessarily, no. You know, you're reminding me, that's all well said. And all of this, by the way, is making me, some podcasts make me want to, you know, eat something. We're talking about food. This makes me want to go out for a walk and exercise. But, you know, you reminded me a memory I have. It wasn't that long ago that I will never forget, is when, must have been when Stephanie was coming up for, must have been maybe promotion or tenure. I don't know which it was, but I was on the faculty personnel committee, mm-hmm. and I was assigned to observe her teach one of her group exercise classes. Mm-hmm. Right. And so there are, I don't know, 30 students in their gym shorts, Stephanie, and I'm sitting in a folding chair in my, you know, street clothes, my you know, sports coat. I mean, I just felt like such an idiot. I didn't have time. I would have loved to have worn shorts, and, you know, I just didn't have time because I had to rush to a class of my own right afterwards. I think I was teaching right before too, but I just felt, my God, I just want to crawl under this chair. I'm so embarrassed. You know, I'm so, but she was great. It was fantastic. And it was hard to sit still. I remember the music. I mean, I don't know if it was an aerobics or what it would have been, but it was a group exercise class, and it was really fun to watch. All well said. So, young people listening, come to Gustavus and certainly take courses with Professor Russell and others in her department, even if you don't major in exercise physiology. This has been super interesting. I mean it about maybe team teaching at some point. That sounds so, it'd be a way to explore gender, and I could learn more about psychology. Oh, and the other thing I want to say, by the way, what you just said about sport and people assuming they know, you know, everything about it or a lot about it, I feel exactly the same way. I think my colleagues do too, about people's attitude toward history, mm-hmm. right? So just anybody can do history. You know, history, what's that? I don't know. In fact, right, there are, you know, historical thinking is a skill. You're not born with it. And yeah, just because you participated in sport doesn't mean you understand everything about it. I think that's a profound point you just made. And certainly you're good at opening students' minds in that regard. So this has just been fun. Thank you so much. It's been fun to chat with you and get to learn more about your work. I didn't know that about your injury, which you know, you've certainly come back from. How old were you? 16, you said, when that happened?
16. That was, I think I've had 3 knee surgeries on that knee, but it's all part of it.
Yeah. Wow. Well, I worry. I sometimes joke about people. Some of the people I'm talking about, we're alluding to, you know, people I know who are, I would describe as exercise fanatics, and they exercise so much that they wind up, you know, they need knee replacements. They need this. Is that happening at a younger age too? I mean, is this extreme sports? I mean, it seems like the number of injuries occurring among young kids is really skyrocketing. Or am I wrong about that?
No, you're right. So there's been this trend, and it really started in the 80s, but has been much more pronounced over the past 10 to 20 years in early sport specialization. And that is kids choosing one sport and playing one sport year round before the age of 12. Okay. And one of the things that happens with that is an increased risk of injury. It also comes with some negative psychosocial potential outcomes, like being burnt out or not liking sports anymore. And one of the areas that I'm hoping to work on in my sabbatical next year is thinking about the impact of sport participation on long-term physical activity. Because for most of us, we're never going to be a professional athlete. The ultimate goal of sport should be you have some fun, learn some skills, and then become a physically active adult.
Right.
Don't see that happening. sport participation in youth actually is not a good predictor of physical activity in life. And one of the theories that's been proposed about that is because of the high risk of chronic injuries. And that's especially true in sports like football, where there is a lot of collisions, where there may be unhealthy body types promoted, which puts increased pressure on the body. So sport can be both a health promoting and not so health promoting physical form of exercise.
Wow. Again, I just learned something. So I would have thought, yeah, being athletic as a kid is a predictor, but not necessarily. All right, we're going to leave it there. This is my version of the Minnesota Long Goodbye on the podcast, because I keep thinking of things I want to talk about. So, Haley, again, it's been a pleasure. Take good care. Good luck with the J term. Thanks so much, and hope to see you on campus at some point soon.
Thanks so much, Greg. We'll go for a walk in the Arb.
Oh, that would be fun. I would love that. All right, take care. Bye-bye. Learning for Life at Gustavus is produced by J.J. Aiken and Matthew Dobosensky of the Gustavus Office of Marketing. Gustavus graduate Will Clark, class of 20, who also provides technical expertise to the podcast, and me. The views expressed in this podcast are not necessarily those of Gustavus Adolphus College.